which reduced that demand in later times. Intentions, whether good or bad, do not predestine outcomes. Chapter 4. The World of Numbers. When trying to understand economic and social disparities, statistics are often used, both to convey the magnitude of those disparities and to try to establish their causes. To some, numbers may convey a sense of objective, hard facts. But even when the numbers are correct, the words that describe what the numbers are measuring may be incorrect or misleading. These include such basic numbers as income, unemployment rates, and rates of arrest for violations of laws. Numbers may also be misleading, not because of any intrinsic defects in either the numbers themselves or in the words describing them, but because of implicit assumptions about the norms to which those numbers are being compared. Here, the seemingly invincible fallacy of assuming an even or random distribution of outcomes as something to expect, in the absence of such complicating causes as genes or discrimination, can make many statistics that show very disparate outcomes be seen as indicating something fundamentally wrong in the real world, rather than something fundamentally wrong with the assumptions behind the norms to which those outcomes are being compared. Neither logic nor empirical evidence provides a compelling reason for expecting either equal or random outcomes among individuals, groups, institutions, or nations. When used with an awareness of their pitfalls, statistics can be enormously valuable in testing competing hypotheses about disparate outcomes. But statistics may nevertheless be grossly misleading when they are distorted by errors of omission or errors of commission. Errors of omission. The mere omission of one crucial fact can turn accurate statistics into traps that lead to conclusions that would be demonstrably false if the full facts were known. This often happens in comparisons of different ethnic groups and different income classes, among other comparisons. Group disparities. During a long and heated campaign in politics and in the media during the early 21st century, claiming that there was rampant discrimination against black home mortgage loan applicants, data from various sources were cited repeatedly, showing that black applicants for the most desirable kinds of mortgages were turned down substantially more often than white applicants for those same mortgages. In the year 2000, for example, data from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights showed that 44.6% of black applicants were turned down for those mortgages, while only 22.3% of white applicants were turned down. These and similar statistics from other sources set off widespread denunciations of mortgage lenders and demands that the government do something to stop rampant racial discrimination in mortgage lending institutions. The very same report by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, which showed that blacks were turned down for conventional mortgages at twice the rate for whites, contained other statistics showing that whites were turned down for those same mortgages at a rate nearly twice that for Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians. While the rejection rate for white applicants was 22.3%, the rejection rate for Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians was 12.4%. But such data seldom, if ever, saw the light of day in most newspapers or on most television news programs, for which the black-white difference was enough to convince those journalists that racial discrimination was the reason. This conclusion fit existing preconceptions, apparently eliminating a need to check whether it also fit the facts. This one crucial omission enabled the prevailing preconception to dominate discussions in politics, in the media, and in much of academia. One of the very few media outlets to even consider alternative explanations for the statistical differences was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which showed that 52% of blacks had credit scores so low that they would qualify only for the less desirable subprime mortgages, as did 16% of whites. Accordingly, 49% of blacks in the data cited by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution ended up with subprime mortgages, as did 13% of whites and 10% of Asians. But such statistics, so damaging to the prevailing preconception that intergroup differences in outcomes showed racial discrimination, in the sense of discrimination too, were almost never mentioned in most of the mass media. The omitted statistics would have undermined the prevailing preconception that white lenders were discriminating against black applicants. However, that preconception at least seemed plausible, even if it failed to stand up under closer scrutiny. But the idea that white lenders would also be discriminating against white applicants and in favor of Asian applicants lacked even plausibility. What was equally implausible was that black-owned banks were discriminating against black applicants. But in fact, black-owned banks turned down black applicants for home mortgage loans at a higher rate than did white-owned banks. Household income statistics. It is unfortunately not uncommon to omit statistics that are discordant with prevailing preconceptions. This has become a common practice in politics, in the media, and even in much of academia. Such errors of omission are not confined to mortgage loan issues, but are also common in many discussions of income statistics. Household income data, for example, are often used to indicate the magnitude of economic disparities in a society. But to say that the top 20% of households have X times as much income as the bottom 20% of households exaggerates the disparity between flesh and blood human beings, which can be quite different from disparities between income brackets. That is because, despite equal numbers of households in each 20%, there are far more people in the top 20% of households. Census data from 2002 showed that there were 40 million people in the bottom 20% of households and 69 million people in the top 20% of households. Such facts are usually omitted in statistics about disparities in incomes. No doubt people in the top quintile average higher incomes than people in the bottom quintile, but the fact that there were also 29 million more people in this top quintile exaggerates the disparity in incomes among people. Later data for 2015 from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics indicated that there were now over 36 million more people in the top quintile than in the bottom quintile. Moreover, the number of people earning income was four times as great in the top quintile as in the bottom quintile. That is yet another of the errors of omission, when the truth would undermine a prevailing preconception. There are not only different numbers of people per household at different income levels, there are also different numbers of people per household from one ethnic group to another, and different numbers of people per household from one time period to another. Omitting those differences when drawing conclusions can distort the meaning or implications of those statistics. As the Bureau of the Census pointed out more than half a century ago, the number of households has been increasing faster than the number of people. In short, American households tend to contain fewer people per household over time, a trend continuing into the 21st century. There are not only smaller families in later times, more individuals are financially able to live in their own individual households, rather than live with relatives or roommates, or live as individual roomers or in boarding houses, as average incomes rise from generation to generation. When income per person is rising over the same span of years when the average number of persons per household is declining, that can lead to statistics indicating that the average household income is falling, even if all individual incomes are rising. For example, if per capita income rises by 25% over some span of years, during which the average number of persons per household declines from 6 persons to 4 persons, then 4 people in the later period have as much income as 5 people had in the earlier period. But that is still less income than 6 people had in the earlier period, so average household income falls, statistically, even if income per person has risen by 25%. Household income statistics can be misleading in other ways. If two low-income people are sharing an apartment in order to make the cost of rent less burdensome to each, and if either or both has an increase in salary, that can lead to one tenant moving out to live alone in another apartment, and that in turn can lead to a fall in average household income. If, for example, each of the two tenants has an income of $20,000 a year, and later both reach an income of $30,000 a year, leading to each living in a separate apartment afterwards, that will mean a fall in household income for these individuals from $40,000 a year to $30,000 a year. There will now be two low-income households instead of one, and each household will be poorer than the one they replaced. Again, a rise in individual income can be reflected statistically as a fall in household income. Since most income is paid to individuals rather than to households, and individual always means one person, while household can mean any changeable number of persons, why would household income statistics be used so often instead of individual income statistics? Clearly, omitting individual income statistics and using household income statistics instead is less useful to someone seeking the truth about economic differences among human beings. But household income statistics can be very useful for someone promoting political or ideological crusades based on statistics that exaggerate income disparities among people. Time and turnover. Another factor often omitted or distorted in discussions of income disparities is the time dimension. People in the bottom 20% are often spoken of as the poor, and if the income in that quintile has not changed much over some span of years, it may be said that the income of the poor has stagnated. But the great majority of people initially in the bottom quintile do not stay there permanently. Most of the people in that bottom quintile initially are likely to be gone in later years, precisely because their incomes have not stagnated, and our concern is for the fate of flesh-and-blood human beings, not the fate of abstract statistical categories. A University of Michigan study that followed a given set of working Americans from 1975 to 1991 found that 95% of the people initially in the bottom 20% were no longer there at the end of that period. Moreover, 29% of those initially in the bottom quintile rose all the way to the top quintile, while only 5% still remained in the bottom 20%. Since 5% of 20% is 1%, only 1% of the total population sampled constituted the poor throughout the years studied. Statements about how the income of the poor fared during those years would apply only to that 1% of the people. Similar distortions of reality occur when the time dimension is ignored in discussing people in the upper income brackets, who are often also spoken of as if they were an enduring class of people rather than transients in those brackets, just like the poor in lower brackets. Thus, a New York Times essay in 2017 referred to this favored fifth at the top of the income distribution as having collected, since 1979, a far greater amount of income than others. Considering how much turnover there was among people in different quintiles from 1975 to 1991, the implicit assumption that there were the same people in the top quintile over the even longer period from 1979 to 2017 is a staggering assumption. But of course, the very idea of turnover was omitted. Another of the relatively few statistical studies that followed a given set of Americans over a span of years found a reality very different from what is usually portrayed in the media, in politics, or in academia. At some point between the ages of 25 and 60, over three-quarters of the population will find themselves in the top 20% of the income distribution. For most Americans in other quintiles to envy or resent those in the top quintile would mean envying or resenting themselves, as they will be in later years. Calling people in particular income brackets the poor or the rich implicitly assumes that they are enduring residents in those brackets, when in fact most Americans do not stay in the same income quintile from one decade to the next. The turnover rate among people in the highest income brackets is even greater than that of the population in general. Fewer than half the people in the much-discussed top 1% in income in 1996 were still there in 2005. People initially in the top 100th of 1% had an even faster turnover, and those with the 400 highest incomes in the country turned over fastest of all. Crime statistics and arrest statistics. Some of the most gross distortions of reality through errors of omission have involved quite simple omissions. No one needs to be an expert on the complexities of statistics in order to see through many statistical fallacies, including those based on simple omissions. But it does require stopping to think about the numbers instead of being swept along by a combination of statistics and rhetoric. Statistics cited in support of claims that the police target blacks for arrests usually go no further than showing that the proportion of black people arrested greatly exceeds the roughly 13% of the American population who are black. If anyone were to use similar reasoning to claim that National Basketball Association, NBA, referees were racially biased because the proportion of fouls that referees call against black players in the NBA greatly exceeds 13%, anyone familiar with the NBA would immediately see the fallacy, because the proportion of black players in the NBA greatly exceeds the proportion of blacks in the American population. Moreover, since blacks are especially overrepresented among the star players in the NBA, the actual playing time of black players on the floor would be even more disproportionately higher, and it is the players on the floor who get cited for fouls more so than secondary players sitting on the bench. What would be relevant to testing the hypothesis that blacks are disproportionately targeted for arrest by the police or disproportionately convicted and sentenced by courts would be objective data on the proportions of particular violations of the law committed by blacks, compared to the proportions of blacks arrested, convicted, and sentenced for those particular violations. Such objective data are not always easy to come by, since data reflecting actions by the police would hardly be considered valid as a test of whether the actions of the police were warranted. However, there are some particular statistics that are both relevant and independent of the actions of the police. The most reliable and objective crime statistics are statistics on homicides, since a dead body can hardly be ignored, regardless of the race of the victim. For as long as homicide statistics have been kept in the United States, the proportion of homicide victims who are black has been some multiple of the proportion of blacks in the population. Moreover, the vast majority of those homicide victims whose killers have been found were killed by other blacks, just as most white homicide victims were killed by other whites. Since the homicide rate among blacks is some multiple of the homicide rate among whites, it is hardly surprising that the arrest rate of blacks for homicide is also some multiple of the rate of homicide arrests among whites. It has nothing to do with the proportion of blacks in the general population, and everything to do with the proportion of blacks among people who commit a particular crime. Another violation of the law that can be tested and quantified, independently of the police, is driving in excess of highway speed limits. A study by independent researchers of nearly 40,000 drivers on the New Jersey Turnpike using high-speed cameras and a radar gun showed a higher proportion of black drivers than of white drivers who were speeding, especially at the higher speeds. This study, comparing the proportion of blacks stopped by state troopers for speeding with the proportion of blacks actually speeding, was not nearly as accepted or even mentioned either by the media or by politicians as other studies comparing the number of blacks stopped by state troopers for speeding and other violations with the proportion of blacks in the population. Yet again, specific facts have been defeated by the implicit presumption that groups tend to be similar in what they do, so that large differences in outcomes are treated as surprising, if not sinister. But demographic differences alone are enough to lead to group differences in speeding violations, even aside from other social or cultural differences. Younger people are more prone to speeding, and groups with a younger median age have a higher proportion of their population in age brackets where speeding is more common. When different groups differ in median age by a decade, or in some cases by two decades or more, there was never any reason to expect different groups to have the same proportion of their respective populations speeding, or to have the same outcomes in any number of other activities that are more common in some age brackets than in others. The omission of data on the proportion of blacks, or any other racial group, engaged in a given violation of law, as distinguished from the proportion of blacks or others in the population at large, is sufficient to let racial profiling charges prevail politically, despite their inconsistency with either logic or evidence. Some professional statisticians have refused to get involved in racial profiling issues. As a professor of criminology in North Carolina explained, good statisticians were throwing up their hands and saying, "This is one battle you'll never win. I don't want to be called a racist." Among the other consequences is that many law enforcement officials also see this as a politically unwinnable battle and simply back off from vigorous law enforcement, the results of which could ruin their careers and their lives. The net result of the police backing off is often a rise in crime, of which law-abiding residents in black communities are the principal victims. Some people may think that they are being kind to blacks by going along with unsubstantiated claims of racial profiling by the police. But, as distinguished black scholar Sterling A. Brown said long ago, kindness can kill as well as cruelty, and it can never take the place of genuine respect. Errors of commission. Statistical errors of commission include lumping together data on things that are fundamentally different, such as salaries and capital gains, producing numbers that are simply called income. Other errors of commission include discussing statistical brackets as if they represented a given set of flesh-and-blood human beings called the rich, the poor, or the top 1%, for example. Errors of commission also include using survey research to resolve factual issues that the inherent limitations of survey research make it unable to resolve. Capital gains. While annual income statistics for individuals avoid some of the problems of household income statistics, both of these sets of statistics count as income, one, annual salaries earned in a given year, and, two, income from capital gains accrued over some previous span of years and then turned into cash income during a given year. Treating the incomes earned by some individuals over various numbers of years as being the same as incomes earned by other individuals in just one year is like failing to distinguish apples from oranges. Capital gains take many forms from many different kinds of transactions. These transactions range from sales of stocks and bonds that may have been bought years earlier to sales of a home or business that has increased in value over the years. If a farm was purchased for $100,000 and then, 20 years later, after the farmer has built barns and fences and made other improvements to the land and the structures on it, the farm is then sold for $300,000, that sale will result in a net increase of the owner's income by $200,000 in the particular year when the farm is sold. Statistically, that $200,000 that was earned over a period of 20 years will be recorded the same as a $200,000 salary earned by someone else in just one year. Looking back, that farmer has in reality earned an average of $10,000 a year for 20 years, as increases in the value of the farm through the investment of time, work, and money on the farm. Looking forward, the farmer cannot expect to earn another $200,000 the following year, as someone with a $200,000 annual salary can. Capital gains in general are recorded in income statistics as being the same as an annual salary, when clearly they are not. Nor is there some easy formula available to render salaries and capital gains comparable, because capital gains by different individuals accrue for differing numbers of years before being turned into cash income in a given year. If capital gains were equally present at all income levels, say 10% of all incomes being capital gains, then the disparities in income statistics might not be affected much. But in reality, low annual incomes are far more likely to be salaries, and very high annual incomes are far more likely to be capital gains. While people making $20,000 a year are probably getting that from a salary, people making $20 million a year are more likely to be making such a sum of money from capital gains of one sort or another. The exceptionally high rates of turnover of people at very high income levels reinforce this conclusion. Internal Revenue Service data show that half the people who earned over $1 million a year at some time during the years from 1999 and 2007 did so just once in those 9 years. This does not imply that all the others in that bracket made $1 million every year. Another study, also based on tax data, showed that among Americans with the 400 highest incomes in the country, fewer than 13% were in that very high bracket more than twice during the years from 1992 to 2000. The highest incomes are usually very transient incomes, reinforcing the conclusion that these are transient capital gains rather than enduring salaries. All of this distorts the implications of income statistics that treat annual salaries and multi-year capital gains as if they were the same. Talk of how much a country's income is received by the top 10% or top 1% proceeds as if this is a given set of people when, because of a high turnover and high income brackets, there can be thousands of people in the top 400 during just one decade. When incomes received by thousands of people are reported statistically as if these were incomes received by hundreds of people, that is a several-fold exaggeration of income disparities. Sidebar: Capital Gains and Inequality. A hypothetical example may illustrate how income statistics can exaggerate inequality when they make no distinction between 1. People who receive annual salaries in a given year, and 2. People who receive capital gains in that same year, representing income earned over a previous span of years. If, for example, there are 10 people who are in a high income bracket, each earning $500,000 a year, while there are also 10 people in a lower income bracket, each earning $50,000 a year, it might seem as if there is a 10-to-1 difference in income between people in these two brackets. But if only one of the 10 people in the higher bracket is earning $500,000 every year in a decade, while the others are there for just 1 year in that decade, the year in which their accrued capital gains are turned into cash income, then given the very high rate of turnover in very high income brackets, the situation is very different from what it would be if there were the same 10 people in the higher bracket every year of the decade. If most of the people in the higher income bracket have a 1 year spike in income from capital gains, after which they return to some lower level of income, which may still be above the national average, say an individual income of $100,000 a year, then over the course of a decade, the income disparity between people is substantially less than the income disparity between income brackets. In this hypothetical example, where there are 9 people initially in the higher income bracket, earning $500,000 each in the first year covered, and $100,000 in each of the subsequent 9 years of the decade, that adds up to a total of $1.4 million each during that decade, which in turn adds up to $12.6 million for all 9 people collectively. The 10th member of the top bracket, who is in that bracket every year of the decade, receiving $500,000 a year in all 10 years, has a total income of $5 million. For all these particular 10 people put together, that adds up to $17.6 million received collectively in a decade by the 10 people initially in the higher bracket. Meanwhile, among the 10 people in the lower income bracket, receiving $50,000 a year each initially and throughout the decade, that adds up to $500,000 each in a decade, for a total income of $5 million as a group. With the 10 people initially in the higher bracket earning a total of $17.6 million during that same decade, and the 10 people initially in the lower bracket earning a total of $5 million during that decade, the disparity in income between people is less than 4-to-1, while the disparity in income between the respective income brackets is 10-to-1. That is because 9 of the 10 people in the higher bracket are replaced each year by someone else having a 1 year spike in income from capital gains for an income of $500,000 in this example. Counting all 91 people who are in the higher income bracket at some point during the decade, their average annual incomes are less than 3 times that of people in the lower bracket. Although this exercise assumes, for the sake of simplicity, that people in the lower income bracket have constant incomes throughout the decade, data from the real world show the incomes of people initially in lower income brackets to usually be rising, over time, more sharply than the incomes of people initially in higher brackets. This would make the disparity in incomes between people in these two brackets even less than that in this example. A hypothetical example cannot pretend to be an exact replica of the real world. The point is merely to illustrate how, under some approximation of these conditions, the disparities between income brackets can be much greater than the disparities between actual flesh and blood human beings. Racial and ethnic disparities. In trying to determine the reasons for economic and social disparities between blacks and whites, some observers attribute these differences primarily to policies and practices by people outside the black community, while other observers attribute these same differences to internal differences in behavior between black and white Americans. In seeking to resolve this issue, sociologist William Julius Wilson relied heavily on statistics from opinion surveys. These surveys, according to Professor Wilson, show that nearly all ghetto residents, whether employed or not, support the norms of the work ethic. In one survey, fewer than 3% of the black respondents from ghetto poverty census tracts denied the importance of plain hard work for getting ahead in society, and 66% expressed the view that it is very important. After admitting that surveys are not the best way to get at underlying attitudes and values, Professor Wilson nevertheless presents, as a refutation of media perceptions of underclass values and attitudes in inner-city ghettos, the fact that residents in inner-city ghetto neighborhoods actually verbally endorse, rather than undermine, the basic American values concerning individual initiative. Despite William Julius Wilson's reliance on opinion surveys to refute claims that ghetto residents have different cultural values from those of the American population as a whole, there is no necessary correlation between what people say and what they do. A survey of low-income people by Columbia University researchers showed that 59% regarded buying goods on credit as a bad idea. Nevertheless, most of the families do use credit when buying major durables. The difference between survey results and demonstrable realities was also pointed out by the author of Hillbilly Elegy. In a recent Gallup poll, Southerners and Midwesterners reported the highest rates of church attendance in the country. Yet actual church attendance is much lower in the South. He also found another survey indicating that working-class whites worked more hours than college-educated whites to be demonstrably false. Those who did the survey called around and asked people what they thought. The only thing that report proves is that many folks talk about working more than they actually work. If someone with no pretensions of being an academic scholar could see the tenuous relationship between survey results and the realities of life, it is hard to understand why surveys were relied on by Professor Wilson for deciding such a crucial issue as the internal or external sources of racial differences in socioeconomic outcomes. Economists tend to rely on revealed preference rather than verbal statements. That is, what people do reveals what their values are better than what they say. Even when people give honest answers, expressing what they sincerely believe, some people's conception of hard work, for example, need not coincide with other people's conception, even when both use the same words. When black students in affluent Shaker Heights spent less time on their schoolwork than their white classmates did and spent more time watching television, that was their revealed preference. Nor are black and white Americans the only groups with different revealed preferences. In Australia, for example, Chinese students have spent more than twice as much time on their homework as white students did. How surprised should we be that Asian students in general tend to do better academically than white students in general in predominantly white societies such as Australia, Britain, or the United States? The same pattern can be seen among whole nations, as such Asian countries as Japan, Korea, and Singapore likewise show patterns of hard work by their students and academic results on international tests that place these countries well above most Western nations. Statistics compiled from what people say may be worse than useless if they lead to a belief that those numbers convey a reality that can be relied on for serious decision-making about social policies. Incidentally, the high correlation between the amount of work that different groups put into their education and the quality of their outcomes does not bode well for theories of genetic determinism. When we find some race whose lazy students get educational results superior to the results of hard-working students in other races, this would be evidence supporting that hypothesis. But such evidence does not seem to be available. Minimum wages and unemployment. One of the important areas in which survey research has done major damage has been in trying to resolve differences of opinion as to the effect of minimum wage laws on unemployment. Advocates of minimum wage laws argue that such laws raise the income of the poor, while critics argue that these laws cause more of the poor to be unemployed because low-income workers tend to be workers with few skills and/or little work experience, so that employers find them worth employing only at low wage rates. Despite an abundance of detailed statistics on unemployment, this controversy has raged for generations. Part of the problem is that, as we have seen in other contexts, most of what are called the poor are not permanent residents in low-income brackets, any more than other people are permanent residents in other income brackets. Most of the people being paid the minimum wage rate are young workers, and of course they do not remain young over the years. So when people say, as Senator Ted Kennedy once said, minimum wage workers have waited almost 10 long years for an increase, they are not talking about a given set of human beings, but about a statistical category containing an ever-changing mix of people. Because young people are usually, almost by definition, less experienced as workers, their value to a prospective employer tends to be less than the value of more experienced workers in the same line of work. Some young people may acquire valuable work skills through education, but education also takes time, and people grow older with the passage of that time. Often, what younger, inexperienced workers acquire from an entry-level job is primarily the habit of showing up every day and on time, and the habit of following instructions and getting along with others. But simple as such things may seem, the absence of these prerequisites can negate whatever other good qualities a young worker may have. After having acquired work experience in some simple entry-level job, most young beginners go on to other jobs where work experience of some sort may be a prerequisite for getting hired. High rates of employee turnover, sometimes exceeding 100% per year, are common in many entry-level jobs in retail businesses or fast food restaurants. These jobs are stepping stones to other jobs with other employers, though some observers falsely call entry-level jobs dead-end jobs. If workers, in fact, stayed on permanently in such jobs, which usually have no automatic promotions ladder, those workers would, in fact, be in dead-end jobs. But when the average tenure of supermarket employees has been found to be 97 days, that is clearly not the case. Like most things in a market economy, inexperienced and unskilled workers are more in demand at a lower price than at a higher price. Minimum wage laws, based on what third parties would like to see them paid, rather than being based on productivity, can price unskilled workers out of a job. This traditional economic analysis has been challenged by advocates of minimum wage laws, and survey research data has been a major part of that challenge. Back in 1945, Professor Richard A. Lester of Princeton University sent out questionnaires to employers asking how they would respond to higher labor costs. Their responses, which were not along the lines of traditional economic analysis, convinced Professor Lester that the traditional economic analysis was either incorrect or not applicable to minimum wage laws. However, what traditional economic analysis seeks to do is predict economic outcomes, not predict how people will answer questionnaires. Moreover, outcomes are not just the fruition of beliefs or intentions. as we have seen in discussions of the costs of discrimination. Decades after Professor Lester's challenge to traditional economic analysis, other economists, also at Princeton, again challenged traditional economic analysis on the basis of survey research, though this time by surveying the same employers before and after a minimum wage increase, and asking each time how many employees they had. The answers convinced the Princeton economists that the minimum wage increase had not reduced employment. They and their supporters therefore declared the traditional analysis to be a myth. Devastating criticisms of the Princeton economists' conclusions were made by other economists who challenged both the accuracy of their statistics and the logic of their conclusions. But even if the Princeton economists' statistics were accurate, that would still not address the key weakness of survey research in general, which is that you can only survey survivors. And what may be true of survivors need not be true of others in the same circumstances who did not survive in those particular circumstances. An extreme hypothetical example may illustrate the point that is applicable in less extreme situations. If you wished to determine whether playing Russian roulette was dangerous, and did so through survey research, you might send out questionnaires to all individuals known to have played Russian roulette, asking them for information as to their outcomes. After the questionnaires were returned and the answers tabulated, the conclusion from these statistics might well be that no one was harmed at all, judging by the answers on the questionnaires that were returned. Not all questionnaires would have been returned, but that is not uncommon in survey research. Basing your conclusions on the statistical data from this research, you might well conclude that you had discovered the myth that playing Russian roulette was dangerous. This is the kind of result you can get when you can only survey survivors. Professor George J. Stigler, in a critique of Professor Lester's survey research not long after World War II, pointed out that, by parallel logic, it can be shown by a current inquiry of health of veterans in 1940 and 1946 that no soldier was fatally wounded. In the case of minimum wage studies, if all the firms in an industry were identical, then any reduced employment resulting from the imposition of a minimum wage or the raising of an existing minimum wage rate would appear as a reduction of employment in all the firms. But in the more usual case, where some firms in a given industry are quite profitable, others are less profitable, and still others are struggling to survive, unemployment resulting from a minimum wage can push some struggling firms out of the industry and reduce the number of their replacements, now that labor costs are higher and profits more problematical. The only firms that can be surveyed for their employment data, both before and after the minimum wage was imposed or raised, are the firms that were there in both time periods, that is, the survivors. If there has been a net decrease in the number of firms, the employment in these surviving firms need not have gone down at all, regardless of a decline in employment in the industry as a whole. The firms surveyed are like the people who survived playing Russian roulette, which may well be a majority in both cases, though not an indicative majority. Empirically, a study of the effect of minimum wages on unemployment in restaurants in the San Francisco Bay Area found that the principal effect was through some restaurants going out of business and reducing the number of new firms entering to replace them. Those restaurants going out of business were primarily restaurants rated lower in quality. Employment in five-star restaurants was unaffected. In Seattle as well, the response to a higher local minimum wage rate increase was that a number of restaurants simply closed down. A study published by the National Bureau of Economic Research measured employment by hours of work, as well as by the number of workers employed, and concluded that the minimum wage ordinance lowered low-wage employees' earnings by an average of $125 per month in 2016. Thus, a theoretical increase in income from a higher minimum wage became, in the real world, a significant decrease in income. Another problem with trying to determine the effect of a minimum wage law on unemployment is that the proportion of the workforce directly affected by a minimum wage is often small. Therefore, unemployment among that fraction of the workforce can be swamped by fluctuations in the unemployment rate among the larger number of other employees around them. This is less of a problem in situations where most of the employees are earning a wage low enough to be directly affected by a minimum wage law, but five-star restaurants were unlikely to be having inexperienced teenagers delivering food to their customers' tables, even if restaurants like McDonald's or Burger King often have teenagers delivering food over the counter to their customers. Alternative ways of assessing the effect of a minimum wage on unemployment would include gathering data restricted to just the kinds of inexperienced and unskilled workers directly affected, such as teenagers. We have already seen, in Chapter 2, how minimum wage laws affect both teenage unemployment in general and racial disparities in teenage unemployment rates as well. Yet another way of assessing the effect of minimum wage laws on unemployment would be to gather unemployment data on places and times where there have been no minimum wage laws at all, so that these unemployment rates could be compared to unemployment rates in places and times where there have been minimum wage laws, especially where these have been comparable societies, or, ideally, the very same society in the same era, with and without a minimum wage law. By focusing on teenagers in general, or black teenagers in particular, it is possible to see the effects of minimum wage laws more clearly and precisely, since these are workers on whom such laws have their greatest impact, because these are a population most lacking in education, job skills, and experience, and therefore earning especially low wage rates. Moreover, there are extensive statistics on what happened to these populations in the labor markets from the late 1940s to the present. What is most striking about statistics on American teenage unemployment rates in the late 1940s is that, 1, these unemployment rates were only a fraction of the levels of unemployment to which we have become accustomed to seeing in later decades, and 2, there was little or no difference between the unemployment rates of black and white teenagers then. Internationally, unemployment rates have been markedly lower in times and places where neither governments nor labor unions set most wage rates. Most modern nations have had minimum wage laws, but the few that have not have tended to have strikingly lower unemployment rates. These would include Switzerland and Singapore today, and Hong Kong under British rule prior to the 1997 return of Hong Kong to China. There was also no federal minimum wage law in the United States before the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, which impacted wage rates in the construction industry. As for hard data on unemployment rates in these places and times, The Economist magazine reported in 2003 Switzerland's unemployment neared a five-year high of 3.9% in February. But this high, for Switzerland, unemployment rate returned to a more normal, for Switzerland, 3.1% in later years. In 2013, Singapore's unemployment rate was 2.1%. In 1991, when Hong Kong was still a British colony, it too had no minimum wage law, and its unemployment rate was under 2%. In the United States, the last administration with no federal minimum wage law at any time was the Coolidge administration in the 1920s. During President Coolidge's last 4 years in office, the annual unemployment rate ranged from a high of 4.2% to a low of 1.8%. Yet discussions of minimum wage laws, even by academic scholars, are often based on the intentions and presumed effects of these laws rather than being based on empirical evidence as to their actual consequences. Implications. On the larger question of statistical errors in general, whether errors of omission or commission, these errors often seem to support a particular social vision. This suggests the possibility that pursuit of a social cause can affect how causation is perceived or presented to others. Even in the absence of any such concerns, however, the emphasis on complex statistical analysis in economics and other fields, however valuable or even vital such statistical analysis may be in many cases, can lead to overlooking simple but fundamental questions as to whether the numbers on which these complex analyses are based are in fact measuring what they seem to be measuring, or claim to be measuring. Income statistics, which lump together annual salaries and multi-year capital gains, are just one of many sets of statistics which could stand much closer scrutiny at this fundamental level, especially if laws and policies affecting millions of human beings are to be based on statistical conclusions. More broadly, the validity of numbers in general often depends on the reliability of the words describing what those numbers are measuring. Statistics on tax rates, for example, can be grossly misleading when changes in tax rates are described in such terms as a $300 billion increase in taxes or a $300 billion decrease in taxes. All that the government can do in reality is change the tax rate. How much tax revenue that will produce depends on how people react. There have been some times when higher tax rates have produced lower tax revenues, and some other times when lower tax rates have produced higher tax revenues. In the 1920s, for example, the tax rate on the highest incomes was reduced from 73% to 24%, and the income tax revenue rose substantially, especially tax revenues received from people in the highest income brackets. Under the older and higher tax rate, vast sums of money from wealthy investors were sheltered in tax-exempt securities, such as municipal bonds, an amount estimated to be three times the size of the annual federal budget and more than half as large as the national debt. Tax-exempt securities tend not to receive as high a rate of return on investments as other securities whose earnings are taxed. What this meant was that sufficiently lower tax rates made it profitable for wealthy investors to take their money out of tax shelters and invest it in the market economy, where there was a higher rate of earnings, leaving them better off on net balance, even after paying income taxes that they had avoided before. In terms of words on paper, the official tax rate was cut from 73% to 24% in the 1920s. But in terms of events in the real world, the tax rate actually paid on staggering sums of money previously hidden in tax shelters rose from 0% to 24%. This produced huge increases in tax revenues received from high-income people, both absolutely and as a percentage of all income taxes collected. That is because 24% of something is larger than 73% of nothing. Tax rate cuts in some later administrations also led to increases in tax revenues. For example, a front-page news story in the New York Times of July 9, 2006 said, "An unexpectedly steep rise in tax revenues from corporations and the wealthy is driving down the projected budget deficit this year." However unexpected this increase in tax revenues, after tax rates had been cut, may have been to the New York Times, others who had been following economic history would know that this had happened before under administrations of both political parties. But none of these facts has made the slightest difference to those who continue to call tax rate reductions tax cuts for the rich, even when high-income people end up paying more tax revenue than before. The very possibility that tax rates and tax revenues can move in opposite directions has seldom been mentioned in the media, a crucial error of omission. Similarly, people who discuss raising the government-mandated minimum wage rate talk as if this would automatically mean having the lowest-paid workers' income rise from $10 an hour to $15 per hour, for example. In reality, for millions of inexperienced and unskilled young workers, it can mean that the wages they receive in fact fall from $10 an hour to zero when they are unable to find jobs. Even those who have and keep their jobs can nevertheless end up with lower incomes as a result of having fewer hours of work available in the wake of a minimum wage increase, as a National Bureau of Economic Research study showed happened in Seattle in 2016, for example. Statistics matter greatly, but so do the words used to describe those statistics. Unless we are prepared to stop and think beyond the words to the realities, we are all too likely to be manipulated and stampeded by a heady mixture of numbers and rhetoric. Chapter 5. Social Visions and Human Consequences. Many people may expect discussions of economic and social disparities to end with solutions, usually something that the government can create, institutionalize, staff, and pay for with the taxpayers' money. The goal here is entirely different. There has never been a shortage of people eager to draw up blueprints for running other people's lives. But any solution, however valid as of a given moment under given conditions, is subject to obsolescence at some later time under changed conditions. The hope here is that clarification is less perishable and can be applied to both existing issues related to economic and social disparities and to new issues involving the same subject that are sure to arise with the passage of time. Given the limitations of prophecy, the point here is to seek to provide enough clarification to enable others to make up their own minds about the inevitable claims and counterclaims sure to arise from those who are promoting their own notions or their own interests. The Invincible Fallacy. At the heart of many discussions of disparities among individuals, groups, and nations is the seemingly invincible fallacy that outcomes in human endeavors would be equal, or at least comparable, or random, if there were no biased interventions on the one hand, nor genetic deficiencies on the other. This preconception, which spans the ideological spectrum, is in utter defiance of both logic and empirical evidence from around the world and over millennia of recorded history. As noted in Chapter 1, individual prerequisites for success in various endeavors may be more or less normally distributed, as in a bell curve, but that does not mean that the presence of all the prerequisites simultaneously will also be normally distributed. Whether among human beings or in nature, highly skewed distributions of outcomes with multiple prerequisites have been common around the world. Nevertheless, the fallacy persists that skewed distributions of income, employment, and other social outcomes show either discrimination or genetic deficiencies. The human species can be divided and subdivided in many ways, by race, sex, age, birth order, or by the different geographic settings in which people have lived, coastal peoples compared to inland peoples, mountain peoples compared to peoples living in river valleys, and so on. Among all these subdivisions and others, large disparities in outcomes have been the rule, not the exception. The real per capita income that Britain reached in 1880 was not reached by Spain until 1960 and by Portugal until 1970. And, at these later dates, the real per capita income in both Spain and Portugal was not quite half that in contemporary Britain. Homicide rates in Eastern Europe have, for centuries, been some multiple of homicide rates in Western Europe, and homicide rates in different regions of the United States have likewise differed by some multiple. Yet Britain had no power to suppress the economic development of Spain or Portugal, just as Western Europe had no power to make the homicide rate higher in Eastern Europe. Disparities do not imply discrimination, nor is discrimination automatically excluded. It is one of many possibilities, each of which has to establish its claims with evidence, rather than being an automatic presumption. As already noted, even such natural phenomena as earthquakes, lightning, and tornadoes likewise show highly skewed distributions around the world as well as within the same country. Thunderstorms are 20 times as frequent in southern Florida as in coastal California, for example. More than half the geysers in the entire world are in Yellowstone National Park. Asia has more than 70 mountain peaks higher than 20,000 feet, and Africa has none. The litany of highly skewed outcomes, both among humans and in nature, is almost limitless. Nevertheless, an implicit assumption persists that equal or at least comparable outcomes would exist among different groups of people except for adverse interventions against some or genetic deficiencies among others. These are not just theoretical issues. The ramifications impact laws and policies. The Supreme Court of the United States has enshrined the prevailing fallacy in the form of its disparate impact standard for presuming discrimination. Yet median age differences among groups, varying by a decade or decades, are alone enough to preclude proportional representation in occupations requiring either long years of experience or the physical vitality of youth, even if all groups were absolutely identical in every other aspect besides age. Age disparities exist among nations as among individuals.